My favorite buildings are all falling down.
6:16 on
my theme song.
I like it.
It's good. Seattle's morning news. Colleen O'Brien, Travis Mayfield, Sully here for you. And Felix Bunnell has entered the house in Pierce County, just east of Tacoma. The house of tomorrow will soon become just a memory of yesterday. Now that FEMA is funding a buyout and demolition of the historic home because it sits in a floodplain. It's a complicated story. That's why we're bringing in Felix Bunnell. So what is going on
here?
Well,
sit back. This is going to take me about a half hour to get through all this. So suspend all the commercials and other traffic reports and everything. Now, the House of Tomorrow, designed and built around 1940 by a Tacoma man named Bert Smizer, who should be much better known. Smizer also designed what's now the Java Jive on South Tacoma Way. You know that building shaped like a giant coffee pot? He also lobbied for the World's Fair to get this be held in Auburn instead of Seattle.
I mean, makes a lot of sense.
You know, there was more property available. There was a cheaper deal. So he was kind of a generally kind of an idea machine. I think he irritated a lot of people, is my guess, just with all these machine guns of ideas. He passed away, Bert Smizer, 1987, age 93. Now, the House of Tomorrow is also doomed. It's in the floodplain along Clark's Creek by the Puyallup River. It's been damaged by water multiple times. So FEMA, that's the Federal Emergency Management Agency, is buying it from the owner. It will likely be demolished sometime next year. Now that, says Michael Lafreniere of the nonprofit group Historic Tacoma, is a shame.
The House of Tomorrow had a particularly interesting design style that he was somewhat known for, a style known as streamlined modern. It was modernistic for its day, curved corners and other elements of design that made it futuristic looking in some ways.
So the outside's white. It's a flat roof. A lot of mahogany and chrome on the interior. It would have looked like a flying saucer in 1940. Now, news of the decision to demolish the House of Tomorrow came as a big surprise to another Michael. Michael Sullivan, a historic preservation consultant and historian in Tacoma and a good friend of this show. This process with FEMA in Pierce County goes back about 5 years. Michael Sullivan was under the impression for most of that time that the House of Tomorrow was going to be moved and preserved. He says that for some reason, the demolition plan has been a well-kept secret.
And I must say, they did not do a good faith effort to make people aware of what the plan was to demolish the building. I mean, I pay attention to this stuff, and I didn't even know about it. I'm on the governor's advisory council, where we're supposed to review memorandums of agreement. And it didn't come before us anywhere. All of a sudden, I read, here's the final report that was offered up as mitigation for the demolition, and it's going to be gone. It was already decided.
Now, Science Kilner is with FEMA. She has a great first name and is the Region 10 Environmental Officer, which means she works on FEMA's various grant programs, including buyouts of homes in the floodplain, which is exactly what we're talking about here. Science Kilner says that Pierce County spent a lot of time and resources investigating the potential of moving the House of Tomorrow and adding up all the estimated costs.
And ultimately, it became very cost prohibitive. And one of the things that FEMA requires when we move a building is a benefit cost analysis. And unfortunately, the numbers just were not favorable.
And the price tag that Pierce County came up with to move the House of Tomorrow was $1.2 million. And so FEMA rejected the option. They made the decision about not moving it. Now, Michael Sullivan says he was blindsided by the decision. So now, with the building set to be demolished, he's irritated by the fact there's no provisions in the final decision that require any of the building materials, you know, that lovely chrome and mahogany interior and all the other old-growth timber.
Yeah.
There's no resources devoted to saving that stuff and no requirement that any of it not go straight to the dump.
If they were going to step back from that move, how did we skip over, especially in a building like this with so much artifact value, how did we skip over redirecting parts of the building away from a landfill, which is what we're looking at now?
I'm looking at the pictures right now.
it is an
impressive home.
Yeah.
And you're right. The materials on the inside could be repurposed. You think all the people that go out to dilapidated barns to pick up the old barn wood, there's got to be a market for what's in this house.
Yeah, and there's a lot of complicated regulations that make this more difficult. And it's not like they're prevented from doing that, but Michael isn't the only one who feels that there should have been some more actual resources devoted to carefully disassembling the building and then making it available to people. Now, Chris Moore is director of the Washington Trust for Historic Preservation. He's actually someone who signed off on the FEMA plan. He was part of the thing. And he says now, in retrospect, he told me in an email yesterday, he wishes now the Washington Trust would push for what he calls a more robust salvage plan and careful deconstruction of the house. What the FEMA agreement does say is that the Puyallup Historical Society can take some materials. Pierce County must make a good faith effort to find a building salvage company willing to recycle the old growth timbers and other reusable elements. We know what good faith ever means, right? Oh, you know, I made a couple phone calls.
Yeah,
sorry.
Right.
Now, but there's
I
no,
tried.
Yeah, but there's no resources available to help with the deconstruction and removal. This is Science Kilner with FEMA again.
And the way that works is those entities have to come in and remove those elements themselves. The county is not going to do that for them.
So Michael Sullivan thinks the FEMA agreement should have had some resources devoted to carefully deconstructing the building so the materials would be less likely to end up in a landfill, especially in these times of climate change. Now, I asked Randy Brake of Pierce County Planning and Public Works if that good faith effort to salvage materials from the House of Tomorrow doesn't amount to anything. Is it true that 100% of the building could end up as waste?
If none of those entities are interested in anything there, that would be predicated on that outcome and result.
So in other words, yes. Now, Michael Sullivan says the lack of a requirement to address the climate-related aspects of the House of Tomorrow is like a canary in the coal mine. There's only going to be more instances of historic or even just vintage buildings demolished because of climate change and more potential waste headed to the landfill.
For those of us in the historic preservation world, sea level rise and climate change are crashing into the fact that in our part of the world, most of our earliest construction and consequently our historic buildings are along our shorelines. And they're in the first line of threat from climate change. So in a way, I see that this as an example of what we're going to see a lot of in the future.
So what Michael Sullivan is saying is that there's an opportunity here for the federal government and the state government to craft policies that are more consistent with other official efforts to address climate change. So if an old building is demolished, the responsible agency will be required to recycle the materials, not just make a good faith effort. Now, Allison Brooks is a state historic preservation officer for Washington. She thinks new policies at the state and federal level are a great idea.
How can we better achieve deconstruction in state and federal policy? That is part of climate change, because taking all this material to the landfill is not good for emissions. It's not helping the situation, and we would be better off recycling material. And there's always the old line that's so true: the greenest thing you can do is recycle a historic building.
So maybe that's a silver lining. Maybe this will spur some kind of legislation. In the meantime, Pierce County has to negotiate the purchase of the building. There'll be a public open house at some point. They're documenting it. They're taking pictures. And then maybe Puyallup, maybe some salvage company will actually stop some of it from all going to the landfill.
So I look at these photos on your Twitter page, and yeah, I see this house, and I think, if this was on Capitol Hill or in Fremont,
yeah,
or in Ballard,
yes,
it would be like celebrated and
exactly
protected, and it would be worth $3 million.
Yeah, and maybe you still could move it. Maybe if somebody really wanted to, they could still step forward and be part of a solution that wouldn't see this thing being demolished. So who knows? It's a complicated story, but anyway, let's hope something good comes of it.
Felix Spinell, thank you very much. We need to turn to a seismic development in the world of pro golf. So let's go to CBS News correspondent Jim Krasula in North Carolina this morning. This news yesterday shocked a lot of folks, Jim. Bring us up to speed here.
That's right. Who saw this coming, Travis? Oh, boy, I'll tell you, the surprise, and that's an understatement, the surprise yesterday, the merger, the announcement of the merger between the PGA Tour, the European Tour, and LIV Golf, of course, from Saudi Arabia, that backed circuit. So, and all of these entities, the three entities, have been fighting legally, bitterly, for the last couple of years, and now they're merging, putting aside their differences and merging. And we'll have to see how all this plays out in terms of the pro golf world. Now, there are already, Travis and Colleen, serious concerns being raised about this potential merger by antitrust enforcers here in the States and in Europe.
What are you hearing from, you know, media takes this morning, or maybe former critics? Does this deal, because, you know, taint the PGA? Because obviously Saudi money comes with a lot of implications, let's just say that, and
sure,
a lot of controversy. So does this
sure
taint the PGA, or do you think the PGA maybe helps the reputation of LIV? I mean, how is this playing this morning? How are people reacting to this?
From what I've seen and heard, Travis, the general reaction to this has been mostly negative. A lot of pro golf pundits, I've heard comments from some directors of major tournaments here in the States critical of this. So again, they're going to have to do PGA is going to have to do a heck of a selling job, it seems to me, in getting people to accept this and move on.
The news still so fresh. It'll be interesting to see how this plays out. Jim Krasula, CBS correspondent, we appreciate your time.
Travis and Colleen, always good to be with you. Take care. Stay well.
7:15 now on Seattle's Morning News. Good morning. I'm Colleen O'Brien with Travis Mayfield and Sully. We continue tracking a growing disaster in Ukraine after a major dam failure near a nuclear power facility. CBS's national security consultant Jeff McCausland is live with us now. Jeff, are we any closer to figuring out who exactly destroyed this dam?
I don't think so. At this moment, I think we're still operating in what I've called the fog of war, Colleen. But to tell you the truth, it would seem pretty obvious to me this was very, very likely done by the Russians. One only needs to think about who would benefit from this. Now, I can't imagine how the Ukrainians benefit from this as they're preparing for this counteroffensive. And this would actually narrow the areas that they can advance in, perhaps interrupt lines of communications. And also is a devastating impact on the Ukrainian people. Tens of thousands of people being forced to flee their homes. Tens of villages and towns now flooded underwater. So I don't see where it's to their advantage. And see where it's to the Russians' advantage, who are on the defense and want to slow that upcoming advance by the Ukrainians, perhaps interrupt their lines of communications. And obviously have shown total disregard to the Ukrainian people. 17 out of 31 days in May, the Russians fired missiles, drones, et cetera, against cities all across Ukraine indiscriminately, killing hundreds of Ukrainian civilians. So blowing up a dam seems to me consistent with that type of an approach that the Russians are doing in this aggressive war.
Yeah, I mean, why exactly would Russia be so desperate as to risk this dam and the nuclear facility? It must mean Ukraine is doing something really right in this war.
Yeah, I mean, you could interpret this, Colleen, you're spot on. This shows a lack of confidence in the Russians and their ability to defend the area because we're going to flood this area. Curiously enough, if you look at back to 1941, the Soviet forces would blow a dam on the same site as the Germans were advancing eastward in an effort to slow them down. And in 1944, the Germans, as they were retreating, would blow the dam again to try to slow the advance of the oncoming Soviet forces. So Russians clearly expecting this counteroffensive by Ukraine right now, destroying this particular dam, would seem logical in military terms, though it's contrary, frankly, to international law. I would argue it's a war crime. And hopefully when this all comes to a conclusion, those who perpetrated this will be prosecuted.
Obviously, so many layers to this, Jeff. We obviously know folks have to be evacuated. Just the risk of flooding in general, the nuclear plant that is so close here, the concerns there. We're hearing about the things being washed up and away, chemicals, fertilizers, oil products, those kind of things. But one of the things I want to ask you about is the idea of this flood now exposing underground mines planted along the banks of the river. I mean, that seems just like one thing on top of another, but that seems especially dangerous.
Well, precisely so. Though the exposing them, that does make it easier perhaps to destroy them if you're able to move through there than if they're concealed. So far, at least, as far as the Zaporizhia nuclear power plant, which is upriver from where this particular dam was, the IAEA, International Atomic Energy Agency, which has observers there at the power plant, which is under Russian control, say there's sufficient water in the ponds around that particular power plant to cool the fuel rods in the reactor to avoid any kind of a nuclear disaster, at least for the time being. So at least right now, the reports are that seems to be, in fact, secure. But this is a wide-ranging ecological disaster. You know, I would draw an equivalency to in 1991 when I commanded a battalion during the Gulf War and we arrived in Kuwait. What are we confronted by? Well, we're confronted by these massive oil fires as the Iraqis were retreating. They set fire to all these Kuwaiti oil fields. And so there's this wall of flame all along the coast of Kuwait. This type of an ecological disaster with this flood, similar in many, many ways.
What has America's involvement been so far, you know, financial aid, weapons, and at what point will an international body move in and try to put an end to this war?
Well, the United States commitment right now in terms of military assistance has been around $40 billion. Will we probably have to go through an appropriation request by the president sometime around September for additional funding. Overall support to Ukraine, probably $100 billion, which includes for the last several years, which includes economic assistance, humanitarian assistance, as well as military assistance. Significant assistance also provided, I should say, by the Europeans. There's about 50 countries now working with the United States, the so-called contact group, to support Ukraine. And again, I think you also should point out for the Europeans right now are hosting probably somewhere around 5 million Ukrainian refugees, the majority women, children, and elderly, who have fled Ukraine since this war began. As far as an international body to supervise some type of ceasefire, sadly, I think that's pretty far down the road until we see the war come to a conclusion and some type of a negotiated settlement.
What about this counteroffensive that the the Ukrainian government was basically telling its local media had begun? Where does that stand? And did this dam blast hamper that, or where does this stand?
Well, it's a little unclear, Travis, where we are in that. I think at least the preliminary parts of this counteroffensive have begun, so-called shaping operations, not only operationally on the ground, but also informationally. There has been some advances by Ukrainian forces in and around Bakhmut in the last day or so, which could be part of that. They may be doing what I would call probing, looking for where the weak parts are in the Russian defense prior to executing the major line of advance. This particular flood, it looks to me, is only going to be a negative for them, because, again, it narrows the area where they can go in. So the Russians have perhaps fewer areas that they got to put their significant defense against, number one. Number two, it may interrupt that lines of communications to bring resupply forward from western Ukraine into the battle zone. And number three, of course, the Ukrainian nation now and the government has got to focus their attention not only on this counteroffensive, but providing material assistance to the refugees, et cetera, who are dislocated by this particular flood.
Zooming out, or maybe even zooming in from your perspective, you've covered a number of conflicts, you've been on the ground, you've seen wars happen. Put this one into perspective for us. It seems to escalate quicker than most in the past, or at least maybe it seems that way because America has been so forthcoming with its support for Ukraine that we almost feel a tie to that community as it gets bombarded by Russian forces.
Yeah, I think that's very, very true in many, many ways. This is the first major conventional war that we've seen on the European continent since World War II, or at least since the major wars in the Balkans. And it has exploded very quickly and accelerated very quickly. The refugee flow, for example, has not only been huge, but it occurred over a very brief period of time. If you were the mayor of Warsaw, a city of about 1.3 million people, you had about 250,000 refugees show up in about a week's time. Back in February of 2022, a dramatic change over time. And we've seen dramatic change, but then again, we've also seen periods where this was kind of like World War One. Really, since November of last year until now, the line has been pretty static along this about 1,000 kilometer, 600 mile front. A lot of fighting in around Bakhmut, but we saw, ground being changing hands 50, 100 yards here or there. Now we're seeing perhaps a transition back to more mobile warfare like you might have seen in World War II with the advent of this counteroffensive.
CBS Radio National Security Consultant Jeff McCausland. Thank you, Jeff.
My pleasure.
Time for your daily dose of kindness now, brought to you by Robert W. Baird. Friends and family of a young Lexington, Kentucky boy battling cancer came together for a special surprise. CBS affiliate WKYT's Destiny Quinn with the story.
Buzz cuts are pretty typical for the summer months, but the reason the razor came out for one group of boys is much more meaningful this time.
He went into the hospital with flu-like symptoms the week before Christmas, and ended up not coming home until after the diagnosis in January.
10-year-old Mason Whittington was diagnosed with leukemia on December 22nd. Since then, he's been receiving weekly treatments at UK's Dance Blue Clinic. Right now, he's in the delayed intensification phase, which has been the toughest phase so far.
It's been a hard, hard journey. Certain forms of chemo take the hair out of the fighter. And when that started to happen to Mason, it seemed like it started to take more than just his hair. It started to kind of suck some of his joy.
And I felt like I was lonely and I wanted to hide.
That's when friends and family knew it was time to come together and show their support.
We wanted to create a way for friends and family and teammates, classmates, buddies, and boys and men in his life meant to show up and not only say that we're in your corner, but to prove it. Let's break out the clippers and let's have a haircut party.
Hey, Mason, I just want to let you know that you're not alone because we care for you and we love you.
Shave me. Bald is beautiful. Mason strong.
I love you, Mason.
Here we go.
This is for you, Mason. I'll see you on the baseball field.
Hope you feel better, Mason. This is for you.
Woo-hoo!
Yeah!
Once heads were shaved, it was time for the big reveal.
You're ready to Mason.
Everybody came out and had ball caps on. And Mason had not taken his cap off in several days, over a week. And so all kind of lined up and said, hey, we'll take our hats off with you.
They all shaved their heads.
Made me feel better. And, like, I didn't have to hide anymore.
It was then Mason's turn to use the clippers.
He got to shave his dad's head.
The act of kindness from friends reassured Mason of who he is.
I'm strong, like, I'm good, and, like, keep fighting.
Mason strong!
Isn't that sweet? WKYT's Destiny Quinn reporting.
Good morning. It's 7:49 here on Seattle's Morning News. I'm Travis Mayfield in for Dave. Colleen is here. Sully is here. G is here for the G and Ursula Show, weekdays 9 a.m. to noon here on Cairo Radio.
Yeah.
We're going to talk golf. Are you a fan of golf?
Tiger Woods.
Okay. All right. Okay.
But No, I take that back.
I was like, you want to choose that golfer?
Yeah. Okay. Rewind. Yes. Okay.
Let me get that back.
Take two.
I used to be a fan of Tiger Woods, and I was watching golf in that way. Back in the day when I was growing up, my dad used to follow Calvin Pete, who was a golfer.
Yes.
I used to watch that. But outside of that, But what's going on with golf world?
You have an opinion about this.
Oh, that's right.
Right.
The PGA and LIV have come together. Interesting.
Harmoniously.
Huh. Well, let's go back to a year ago, shall we?
Let's do it.
A year ago, the commissioner of the PGA, Jay Monahan, I mean, he got on CBS as people and players started to defect to LIV, and how dare they go over there? He spoke and used 9/11. He talked about that.
Yeah.
He talked about family and friends that lost loved ones in 9/11. He called those that ignored Saudi Arabia's human rights record. He said, quote, they were living under a rock.
Yeah.
I mean, this guy went on there and he also had a question for all of the PGA players that defected over to LIV. And he said, have you ever had to apologize for being a member of the PGA Tour? And, I mean, there were so many players that took a principled stand. Mm-hmm. So many players that decided to stay and be loyal to the PGA. Be loyal and not be a hypocrite and stay there, right? As a matter of fact, Tiger Woods turned down between $700 and $800 million to go over to LIV to do a golf series.
In Saudi Arabia. Yeah, I'm not sure if we've mentioned yet that LIV is based out of Saudi Arabia.
Saudi-backed, yeah.
Yeah, Saudi-backed.
I said Saudi. So,
okay.
Here we are today.
Yeah.
And they have now merged. And the way that the PGA players, the top PGA players found out about it, they found out about it the same time we all did.
All the push alerts, right?
On Twitter.
Yep.
That's
so
crazy.
The hypocrisy. Yeah. So what's the moral of the story? It reminds me of the movie with Robert Redford and Demi Moore. Indecent Proposal.
Yeah.
And if you ever going to see that movie with your significant other, and then after the movie, there's silence.
Right, yeah.
And you don't really want to talk about it, but you're thinking it.
What's your price?
She's thinking it.
Yeah.
He's thinking it. And then finally, before you know it, you say, Lois, do you have a price?
Right, right.
And Lois says, Charlie, there is no price that I would go and do and leave you.
Yeah.
To which I say, you're lying, Lois.
Yeah.
Everybody has a price.
Obviously.
I'm was your price?
Yeah, I mean, I'm sure when it comes to sharing partners, there can be a price. But when you talk about the human rights violations and just the absolute horrors that members of the gay community face over in that nation and, you know, just everything that happens that, sure. that is really in an anti-American feeling, it's surprising the PGA would do this, and I wouldn't be surprised if there was a revolt from some of the top players saying, no, we're not going to do it.
Doubt
but you
it.
Think even the top players have a price, that they will go through with this despite everything that's been said about yes. LIV in the past?
Yes.
That's disappointing.
Question back to you, Colleen.
Mm-hmm.
Do you think that the PGA will celebrate Pride Month going forward? What about the LPGA?
I don't think they can celebrate Pride Month
golf?
Going forward, given the move they just made. It would be disingenuous mm-hmm. to put a rainbow flag on their logo after this move.
Mm. Or maybe they move the Saudi kingdom forward a step or two.
I want to
believe that could be possible.
One last point going forward. If this can happen to the PGA, can it happen to MLB? Can it happen to
you're
hockey?
You're a fear monger.
Love
what
y'all.
What are you trying to do?
Scott, thank you much. Welcome back to Seattle's Morning News. Cairo Radio's Mickey Gomez joining us now. For the first time in its four-decade history, America's largest lesbian, gay, bisexual, trans, and queer civil rights organization, the Human Rights Campaign, HRC, has declared a national state of emergency for members of the LGBTQ+ community. Mickey? Mm-hmm. You'd argue that maybe this is a little bit too late.
I do. I feel like, you know, it's a four-alarm fire, and they're calling the fire department for the first time to say, hey, come and take care of this. When this probably, according to other people in the community, where I've read comments and spoken to other friends who say that this alarm should have been sounded a long time ago, perhaps maybe even the last legislation, perhaps maybe, you know, when 49 people were killed at Pulse Gay Nightclub in Florida and Club Q in Colorado in November, you know, that they really should have started to sound the alarm then. And then some people also say, okay, HRC's funding must be low. Maybe they're just trying to scare us so that way they can get more donations. That's what I'm hearing in the streets, you know. But what's really interesting is that the group's president, Kelly Robinson, says, and I quote her, LGBTQ+ Americans are living in a state of emergency. The multiplying threats facing millions in our community are not just perceived. They are real, tangible, and dangerous.
So what is this state of emergency? Is it basically just that, a declaration that telling people we are in this state? Or what exactly does this mean?
So what it means is that they have put together a digital guidebook for the LGBTQ. That's why I'm having a hard time saying in our family, we say the LGBTQ community. But they've put together a digital guidebook to let Americans in our community and those who support us to find out which states are hostile to the community. And they want people to go there to check it out, to find out what's happening in your state and what can you do if you want to remain in your state or, you know, how to get the heck out of there. And I'm sure they want donations so that way they can help fight the 417 anti-LGBTQ laws that were introduced the first quarter of 2023.
This is stunning. I find myself sitting here and just counting up all of the precious people in my lives who belong to that community. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I wouldn't have my career today had it not been for three gay men, Travis Mayfield being one of them, who has supported me through my whole career. And it makes me emotional because
I see your tears.
Yeah, you're sitting before me. Travis, you're sitting next to me. I can't imagine what it's like to fear for your life every day.
I do. I fear for my life. I don't live in fear. I try not to live in fear. But we were just talking about it off air and you asked me,
yeah,
you know, what are your plans? What are you going to do? And I said, well, we have a safe. We've got cash. We've got accounts. And we've got passports, we've got our enhanced IDs and driver's license, just in case we have to flee the country.
That you live in America and you have a refugee plan.
I do.
And
she's
Travis,
not alone. We do too.
You do too.
We got our kids. My husband is has Canadian citizenship, and we got our kids Canadian citizenship. And I mean, that's because just in case. We always just say to each other, like, let's do this just in case.
Mm-hmm.
Because I see what's happening in so many places. And I will point out that, you know, this guide that was issued has Washington as a very safe place,
yes,
a very supportive place. But look what just happened yesterday. We have this planning commissioner in Sammamish who feels that it's okay to, during a public meeting, a city meeting, say that, you know, I'm diseased and that I am corrupting children. I mean, that's what he's doing. He's saying that my family doesn't deserve to exist and that mm-hmm. I am making the world a worse place to be. And you, Mickey, are making the world a worse place to be.
Right.
That is hard to hear on a daily basis. And so, yeah, I mean, you know, you might be surprised to hear that we have escape plans, but I bet you that there is not a single LGBTQ person who's listening who is surprised to hear that we have escape yeah. plans.
I mean, my best friend just activated his 2 months ago. They moved to Portugal. They were just tired of being targeted. I mean, granted, they lived in San Francisco and Sonoma, and they live a very plush life, very well-educated men, and they're, you know, we've been best friends for over 30 years, and he said, it's time. We got our visas, we've moved, and Portugal is very accepting. So is Spain. You should move too, is what I say. And we're very happy here. I mean, listen, I will tell you, I'm proud to be an American. I'm proud that my same. Roots are tied to the United States. And I always say this when people yell at me, to this day, in the grocery store, you know, it just happened 2 weeks ago, go back to your country. And I just thought, why would you say that to me? I'm just walking down the aisle here at QFC. What? Where did that come from? And I'll hear that type of rhetoric. And then I remind people, hi, thank you so much for telling me to go back to my country. My country is here. I didn't have to cross a border. A border crossed me.
So bottom line.
This
is real.
Yeah, it is real.
Two people just bared their souls to tell you this is real, that America feels dangerous for a certain community. And if this is not the America you want, then every single day you have to push back and fight for the America you want and protect the LGBTQ plus community. It's up to us to protect you.
Yeah, it is. And I'll have more online. I just reached out to ARC, asked for an interview. Want to know why they waited so late to issue this or to do more, and why they're doing more now. And hopefully we'll hear from them.
All right. Thank you, Mickey and Travis, for sharing.
You're really welcome.
Appreciate it.
Thanks for listening to Seattle's Morning News. I'm Dave Ross.
And I'm Colleen O'Brien. Thanks for listening to the show's podcast. We're happy you're here.
And you can keep up with the show and find some of the stories from today online at MyNorthWest.com.